Hello, my name's Gene Bradley. You're listening to KBOO Radio, 90.7 FM on your community radio dial. Our guest today on Political Perspectives is Alan Weider, here to talk about his new book, Studs Terkel, Politics, Culture, but Mostly Conversation, published by Monthly Review Press. Alan's going to be giving a reading at Broadway Books in Portland on August 30th at 7 p.m., and Broadway Books is at 1714 Northeast Broadway. I'll announce that again at the end of the program. Alan, welcome.
Thanks, Gene. Good to be with you again.
We were going to see if we could find the chair that Studs Terkel sat in here at KBOO in 1994. We weren't able to do that, but it's great to have you here anyway. How did you come to write this book? You say it's been in your mind for 20 years.
Yeah, it definitely has, and I mentioned that a couple times, in the intro and the acknowledgments. So I was an academic oral historian, and I started doing that in 1977. And at about the same time, Studs' stuff was beginning to get popular. He had started writing, and he was known well outside of Chicago. And at about the same exact time, too, the Oral History Association began. And yet, oral history was sort of non-academic, and it was not looked at in high regard. And so I always thought that the reason I was able to do my work in academia and be successful in academia was because of Studs, because Studs gave it credence. And it was a strange kind of credence, because the Oral History Association loved him and hated him. You know, I mean, he wasn't academic enough, but yet he gave oral history prominence. And so starting in the 90s, it was kind of like I was writing the book in my head. It was like I knew that at some point I wanted to do something on Studs Terkel.
Now, you interviewed or talked to hundreds of people who knew Studs Terkel, who knew of Studs Terkel, who were influenced by Studs Terkel. What was that like? How long did that take?
It was a couple-year project, but it was also or more like a three-year project, but it was full-time. I mean, that's what I did.
Yeah.
And people were really forthcoming. The only interesting thing outside of really being privileged to meet wonderful people along the way. But the only thing that was a little strange was that there were, I don't want to say individuals, but it was individuals and groups. There was a lot of ownership of Studs Terkel.
Sure.
You know, so people felt Studs Terkel was theirs. And it goes along with people, as I interviewed them, going, well, I was one of Studs Terkel's 500 best friends. and people believe that.
The inner circle.
Yeah, and it was kind of like the inner circle of everyone. And it was kind of like people that were interviewed by him would say, you know, he just brought you in. You were the only person in the room when he was there. That was sort of double-sided. It was really interesting to me because I'll talk about meeting Studs. I only was with Studs for 15 minutes one time in my life. But when I interviewed people, there were a few people that said, when Studs was with you, he was 100% with you. But there were times when he was 100% not with you.
Right.
So there was this wonderful artist and political woman in Chicago named Pearl Hirschfield. Her husband, Hyman, was a medical doctor who fought along with Quentin Young for socialized medicine since the 40s.
Right.
And Pearl would host all these political events. She had an event for Angela Davis. She hosted all these anti-apartheid fighters coming from South Africa. And Studs was involved, and he always came through for her as an MC. But she was telling me about when she first met him, it was Studs and his wife, Ida, and Pearl and Hyman at PTA meetings for their kids in elementary school. And she said Studs would go out of the room. He was bored to death. He wasn't engaged. And the same thing she said when she had some of her art exhibits. If he didn't like it, he was like, oh, I'll go outside and smoke. You know, he was just not there. And I think I experienced both in 15 minutes, okay? Because he was there to do a panel and to give a talk at something called the American Educational Research Association. This was in 2003. And he was already, he couldn't hear.
Right.
And so you had to be right next to him. And he was introduced to me. People that were running this wanted me to meet him. I had just gotten back from South Africa, from living for 5 months in South Africa. And he was thinking about what he was going to do as a presentation. He was not interested in talking to some professor from South Carolina at the time. And then I said to him, well, I just got back from South Africa. And he just lit up. And he said, I was there in 1963. Do you know? And it became really special for me because his host in South Africa in his visit in 1963 was Nadine Gordimer, who years later wrote the introduction for my book on Ruth First and Joe Slovo. So it was kind of this wonderful connection.
Yeah.
But he just got so engaged. And I saw both sides of Studs in that way.
That's very interesting.
Yeah.
So he was either interviewing you or he wasn't. Right?
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
So he's been called America's great conversationalist. Where did he come from? How did he get here?
Yeah, and I think I try to do this in the book. There were two early things I think that were very important. His folks moved to Chicago when he was 12 years old, and they ran men's hotels.
Mm-hmm.
The last one was called the Wells Grands Hotel.
Right.
And he was absolutely taken by the people that lived there. He was intrigued by them. He listened to them. He was given books by them, and he loved their conversation. And they were from all walks of political life. He was amazed by them, and he reflected on them for years and years and years. So there were Wobblies and anti-union people. I mean,
right.
It just this whole mixture. Then the other part was that as a teenager and then young man, he would go to Washington Park, which was near the hotel. And this place was Bughouse Square, where there were all kinds of both crazed speeches and very good political speeches. And so he was kind of raised on debate. And I think that conversation comes out of that. And then the kicker on that, I think that connects to one of the three things that I think are come out in the book that maybe are the significant things in this book. And that is that it wasn't just conversation, that he believed that without conversation, you couldn't have democracy.
Wow.
That democracy and conversation went hand in hand. Perfect topic for this year, don't you think?
Yes, indeed. And perfect place to be talking about Studs Terkel on KBOO Radio. So, you quote Studs as saying that his formative experiences of learning took place in the world. And that whole neighborhood around Chicago, the Tower Town neighborhood, had so much going on, so much radical politics and nonconformity, as you say. And could you talk a little bit about what that neighborhood was like in total?
Yeah, and I've obviously gotten my understanding of that neighborhood from talking to people.
Sure.
And then from reading Franklin Rosemont's stuff on what was called Hobohemia. And there was a whole collection of people, actors, political people, theater people that were part of that community. And it's hard to get a handle on how much originally Studs was there.
Mm-hmm.
People would write little things about, oh, well, we saw him at Dill Pickle Club,
right,
or we saw him at this place when he was a young man. But I think the thing that he stresses most about being a young man in terms of the neighborhood was going to hear jazz and blues. And his not his oldest brother, but his older brother would take him there. And so I think all this stuff was connected, and it went from his dad listening to Debs on the radio with him,
right,
to going through youth and then going to University of Chicago and taking the bus.
Right.
The bus we can talk about because the bus became is kind of a metaphor for Studs'
right.
life and for conversation. And listing the things that he got out of the University of Chicago, both undergraduate and law school. And first, I think, was the records he got to buy on the corner when he had a bus transfer on the south side of Chicago. Second was, I think, baseball. I don't know. There were a list of things, and law school was way at the end of the list.
He said he went to, and it's amazing because this guy who said he got his education in the world, but he went to University of Chicago in 1928. He goes to law school and gets his law degree. But he says, I went to law school dreaming of Clarence Darrow, but I woke up with Julius Hoffman, the infamous judge of the Chicago 7 trial. So it's just like, wow, I mean, a guy who works all the way through law school. And this is in the beginning of the Depression. He's in school, and he's taking the bus to school every day, and he keeps going.
Yeah. Later on, he said, can you imagine I'm an alumni of the place that supported John Ashcroft and Bernadine Dorn, you know? And he loved doing that. He loved doing these juxtapositions, I guess you call it. He wouldn't use that word, but, you know, placing these ironies and contrasts next to each other.
So after he gets out of law school, after he's gone through all the trouble to go to University of Chicago and law school, he decides to become an actor.
It seems like he wasn't akin to being in the courtroom. And even years later, I think at the 50th anniversary or some such thing of his law school class. He was harassing, I mean, gently and sweetly, sure, but the people that he graduated with about about the law and about law school and about who their contemporaries were. But that said, he also became close to people who had law degrees from Chicago that were fighting against Daley and that kind of thing. So, yeah, he became an actor. And you know, I couldn't figure out exactly where that came from, except when you follow his life and what a ham he was. Mm-hmm. And so when he was still in law school, he was the cover feature for the magazine Official Detective. You know, he was wearing a hat, and he looked like he could have been not a street thug, but some kind of low gangster guy. and Ida, his wife, was interviewed, and she said, "Well, the first time I met him, I thought he was a thug." You know, and so it's funny.
So he starts making money doing these radio soap operas as a gangster.
Yeah,
and applied for a job as a fingertip classifier at the FBI, but he was turned down.
Yeah, and he later on he would talk about when he got his papers, when he got his FBI papers,
got his file.
Yeah, he got his file, and they redacted most of it, but they gave some of it, and part of it was he took pride in being not considered by Hoover one of our types of people. You know, I forget the exact quote, but it was similar.
He thought it was because he was Jewish, but actually it was because of the company he kept.
I guess. and a law professor who had condemned him in the recommendation.
Right.
And you know, and then it turns on its head. The opposite is true at other times in his life. So, for example, even though he was thrown off a TV in the 50s, and I know I'm jumping ahead, he was upset that his friends had to go before UAC, and he didn't.
Yes.
He was upset that he wasn't on Nixon's hate list, you know, and very upset, actually.
Yes. So, but he was acting in socially relevant plays. He was acting in Waiting for Lefty and a lot of social dramas that were happening in the 1930s. So
yeah,
he was ideological in some of his acting anyway.
No, I think to a great extent, and I think that comes from starting in his youth and his dad. And he says even a little bit his mom. That's a whole story in and of itself. But I think the Chicago Repertory Theater was political. And it was political in the sense that they didn't just perform in theater settings. They performed in union halls. They performed in bars. And he writes, you know, early on that one of his huge memories was of the Republic Steel strike and the massacre of Republic Steel workers and performing at the bar for the survivors and a major thing. And that's what they did. And interestingly, not his whole scope, but some of his best friends in life throughout life came from that time. The one that people would know would be Haskell Wexler, the filmmaker.
Right. 1939, his life takes a dramatic turn when he meets and marries Ida Goldberg. Could you talk about his wife, Ida?
Yeah, Ida. I can talk about it. I never met Ida, uh-huh. But people go out of their way to compare her and Studs, and she's in a sense romanticized as this beautiful, thoughtful, wonderful, not blustery woman, and being Studs's major audience. She was from a big Jewish family in rural Wisconsin. That's strange in and of itself. Yeah. And they met in theater. They met, like you mentioned, at the Chicago Repertory Theater. And one of the things that Studs always said about Ida was that she was really the political one.
That I found very interesting, that Studs Terkel, coming from this background up to 1939, describes his wife as the political one.
Even then.
Yes.
Even then. And she went on. She did amazing political things. She got arrested for protesting the Vietnam War in D.C. She was an activist in Chicago involved in peace and anti-war stuff. The best story that I got from people about her politics was sitting on the steps at 4 a.m. of the Black Panther offices in Chicago after the assassination of Fred Hampton and being vigilant with other white women because the Panthers were really afraid of their offices being destroyed. And she, every time one of the Black Panthers came, it was power to the people from this little woman. When I forget if it was when she died or when Studs died, but Gary Wills did one of the eulogies, the writer Gary Wills, mm-hmm. and he said, how do you make a place for Ida in the world of Studs? And he said Studs Terkel was the conscience of Chicago. Studs Terkel was the conscience of the world. Ida was the conscience of the conscience, which I thought was beautiful.
So in the 1940s, Studs really becomes a radio fixture in Chicago, as you say. He really goes beyond the soap operas and the gangster roles and starts doing documentaries, radio dramas. He has a weekly news and commentary. But then he backs away from that as the Cold War begins in 1946.
Well, it was interesting, and I can't say definitively what happened, but one of his co-hosts was dismissed and was accused of being a communist at the time. And it's unclear, and I couldn't figure it out. Mm-hmm. There's a really nice book about WCFL radio and labor radio, but that's what you get out of it, and I couldn't dig. The person I thought might know was Quentin Young, who I can talk about a little as we go on, because I think he's really important to Studs' life. But he said, I probably knew, I just don't remember. When I interviewed Quentin, he was in his 90s. But he did leave that, and yet he couldn't leave it, right?
Right.
Because, I mean, Studs is one of his many, many favorite lines was, I never met a petition I didn't sign.
Okay.
And the story moves up to, you know, 1950. And Studs, you know, he was doing sports casting. He was writing a music column for the Sun Times. He was doing disc jockey work.
The Wax Museum, was that it?
That was the name of his, as a disc jockey, yeah. And so it wasn't political, but he was still going to political events all the time. And maybe the major one in terms of public persona was his support in 1948, and this is a different topic, it's third-party politics, for Henry Wallace's presidential campaign.
Right.
And again, it's a leap of faith, but part of that, there were two things that happened to Studs that I think never left him in terms of maybe J. Edgar was concerned. One was Billie Holiday singing for his going away party when he went for a short time and served in the military during World War II. He never left a desk, but he was there for a while. And the second one, I think, was not so much Henry Wallace, but being with Paul Robeson. And Paul Robeson was persona non grata. In a huge way. In fact, I want to push it a little bit and then I'll come back. But in 1955, after UEC wasn't over, but the major thrust of blacklisting was, he had Paul Robeson on his show. And that was brave. It was a very brave thing to do. And so I think that stuck with him, is that his activities, not his radio show.
Right.
As we come to the 50s.
So the blacklist basically puts him out of work at all this reasonably lucrative, you know, radio work. And even he had an early TV show. But that all sort of comes to a halt when he's on the blacklist. And Ida becomes the support of the family. And so that's how he comes to WFMT radio.
Yeah, WFMT.
And this is like a privately owned local radio station?
Yeah, at the time it was a husband and wife. Until the 60s, actually.
Right,
it was late 60s. It was a husband and wife.
Rita and Bernie Jacobs, I think.
Yeah. And Rita Jacobs. Yeah. And Rita was his initial contact. And, you know, the story, again, one of the things that Studs stood for was truth over facts. You know? And I'm saying that in a positive way, not in a negative way.
That's great.
That you get to something and you don't necessarily have to know the exact date. And the way he has told the story many times was that he called up because he was so shocked that they were playing Woody Guthrie. And it was Christmas Eve or New Year's Eve. He said he'd like to work there. And Rita said, well, we'd love you to work here, but we don't have any money. And he said, well, I don't have any either, so it's all good. You know? But yeah, he went to work there and worked there for 45 years.
And that was the Studs Terkel Show, which became an institution in Chicago. 10 o'clock every morning, weekdays, he was on the air.
Absolutely.
Doing interviews. At one time, he had befriended Mahalia Jackson when he was a music critic, I guess, and actually became the producer of her show, or the host of her radio show on CBS.
Right.
And wasn't going to sign the loyalty oath, and Mahalia said...
It sounds... I mean, when he tells the story, it's great, because the way that he talked about it was when his TV show didn't make it to New York. There were two other shows in Chicago. There was Studs Place, which the actor David Schwimmer refers to as Cheers, written by Clifford Odette. So you figure that out.
Yeah, we got it.
But the other two shows were Kukla, Fran, and Ali, and Dave Garraway at Large, and they both made it to New York. Studs Place was supposed to go.
Yeah.
One of the NBC officials came and said, you need to say that you were duped and sign the loyalty oath. And he said no. And interestingly, he said, you know, it was my pride. It wasn't so much the loyalty oath, although I wouldn't have signed one. But I'm not going to say I'm duped. You know, so he did have pride, and that's a whole other topic. But then again, like you brought up, so the same thing happened with Mahalia's show. And Mahalia said, no studs, no show. And basically, and she came through for him. Both of them came through for each other, but it was Mahalia that set him up for the first time to interview Martin Luther King Jr.
Right, yeah. Right. So that relationship continued to give him entree into a lot of worlds.
Yeah, and initially he and Ida would go to the church where she sang and listen to her sing.
Wow.
Yeah.
Incredible thought.
Yeah, yeah.
During this period of his shows, he really gets into the interviews and reaching out, and he had this conversation with a scientist, Jacob Bronowski. Could you tell us about the impertinent question and how that really influenced that style and his whole approach to interviewing?
Yeah, I think there were two different things that went together on that. And one was he was in London. They met at a party, and it was the time they were talking about the Cuban Missile Crisis. So that gives you the time span. And Bronowski brought that up as about science. That if you don't ask impertinent questions, the questions that nobody asks, you'll never get important answers. And Studs thought about it, and it was, that's the same in terms of social, political, economic, the issues that are important to a democracy, not just science. And so he was able to probe with respect, I think. And the way that he did that was that in some ways he was more – let's take the radio show, for example.
Right.
He'd have authors come on. Two authors in particular spoke to this, Vic Novosky, and whose big book was Naming Names, and about the Blacklist.
And the publisher of The Nation.
The publisher of The Nation, or the editor of The Nation.
The editor, sorry.
And Bud Trillin, Calvin Trillin.
Right.
The writer. And they both said – you come to be interviewed by Studs. Number one, he knows your book better than you do anymore. And number two, he picks something out that is so important that you didn't even know you did. And that's where the questions come from, and that's where the conversations lead.
Wow.
And the other thing that went with this, and Studs said he learned it from one of the women that he interviewed, a woman named Lucy Jefferson. She has a pseudonym in the books initially. And she worked as a nurse's aide, and she always had books with her. And she talked to Studs about something. Well, you can't get to anything unless you have the feeling tone. And the feeling tone was a spirit or a feeling between people that you either had or you didn't have. And Studs found it everywhere. I mean, one of his most amazing interviews was with an ex-neo-Nazi who had become a social worker in Chicago. And part of impertinent questions and feeling tone was the stories that he liked the best and he liked to be part of in conversation were transformation stories of changes in people. He loved to be surprised, I think.
Yeah. He used to say, amaze me to his guests, right?
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
In 1966, his first book, Division Street America, his first oral history, comes out. Can you tell us how that came about? I mean, from his talk show to putting things together in book form?
Sure. And that book, by the way, is still, for many people, they think that's his best book in spite of it being his first of this sort of book. But he did a radio show with a troupe of British theater troupe, and there was a woman named Eleanor Braun, and she was very close friends. God, my brain at this is going blank with help me with this. The publisher,
Andre Schifrin.
Right. Schifrin, yeah. So she was good friends with Lena Schifrin, and she suggested to Andre, you need to talk to this person, Studs Terkel. He does amazing interviews. And Andre got a hold of Studs. First, he read some of his things in the WFMT journal or magazine, mm-hmm. which is now Chicago Magazine, by the way, right. much bigger and stronger and richer. But Andre contacted him and said, well, I'm doing this book, and it's about a village. And might you think about writing a book about Chicago as a village? And Studs thought he was out of his mind. Okay, he said, what are you, crazy? Chicago's not a village. How am I going to do this? But then he took it really seriously. And he interviewed hundreds of people in Chicago. And coming out of the radio show, where he didn't always do interviews either, he sort of was talked into that, about that. I write about this in the book. He did a couple of interviews in 1955 with music people, with Bud Freeman, a jazzer, and with Big Bill Brunsey, the blues guy who became a close friend.
Yes.
And with that, somebody wrote in, a listener wrote in to him, and he had all these letters and postcards and said, that was the best show you've ever had. You need to start doing interviews. And he said, I didn't even think about that. We'll do interviews. You know? And so then Eleanor Braun and then Division Street. And I think he was surprised how well it was received. I mean, and it was raised from the ground. It was this kind of story that we're talking about, and where people would read their own stories. And there's a whole methodological process, but people would read their own stories and go, I do believe that. I didn't even know I believe that.
Right.
You know,
right.
It's just astounding.
That's incredible.
Yeah, and there's story after story like that.
So he goes on to write a number of oral histories, Hard Times, Working, The Good War, just really important books. Can you just briefly tell us the importance of Studs Terkel in this, really establishing this sense of oral history in this country?
Yeah, I think that what he did, and I can't say if people do it better, but not many for sure, if there are any. And what he did, I think, look, when people eulogized him, they talked about, you know, that he was not a man of dogma. It was clear his politics were clear. And he could take people on, but he seldom did that. And I think he really believed in the voices of people from the ground. I mean, he believed in underdogism, if
right.
anything. And so workers, labor, I think the one thing that comes out of my book that I don't think many people think of, or at least, yeah, I don't think many people think of, is how committed he was from the time of youth to anti-racism.
Right.
And so when he interviewed people, and he interviewed, you know, a huge spectrum of people, it wasn't just political people by
right.
any stretch of the imagination, he believed that their stories were important. And he said that you respect the person. You want them, I'm not going to do an exact quote, but you want them to say what they want to say or not say what they don't want to
right.
say
right.
in order to get to their story. So there's an example. This was for his book, Race. He interviewed somebody that I've become friends with from interviewing, a guy called Mark Larson, who was a public school teacher at the time, from a very liberal family. And he Studs is interviewing him, and he's starting to talk about, oh, my God, how racist am I with my students? Huh. And he goes through this whole thing, and he had no idea that was the case.
Wow, that's incredible.
And the other thing about that, Gene, is that he interviewed people that didn't agree with him. Some of the critical reviews were, well, he only interviewed people on the left. He only interviewed mm-hmm. communists. That wasn't true at all. He didn't interview as many, but he interviewed counterpoints all the time. And some of those counterpoints became his transformation stories.
We could talk about this endlessly. We could talk about this book for a week and the life of Studs Terkel, but we've got to end. But okay. I just want to thank you, Alan. This is such an exciting book. It just energized me. And I know its readers will want to go find out more about Studs Terkel, go look at that Studs Terkel archive that they've established of all his radio programs. I mean, this is, it just opens the door into this whole world of his activity and his life. I just want to thank you for writing this book. We've been talking to Alan Weider about his new book, Studs Terkel, Politics, Culture, but Mostly Conversation. It's been a great conversation we've had today. And Alan will be reading from this book at Broadway Books in Portland on August 30th at 7 p.m., 1714 Northeast Broadway. I really encourage you to go and listen to that talk, and you might want to pick up a book. Alan, thank you for joining us today.
Thanks for the conversation.
You betcha.
You're listening to KBOO Portland. This is Political Perspectives. Studs Terkel visited the KBOO studios in 1995 while he was on tour for the book Coming of Age, Growing Up in the 20th Century. It's a portrait of American life and the experience of aging in the 20th century. It featured interviews with 74 very different people, ranging in age from 70 to 99. At KBOO, Studs Terkel spoke with KBOO's Kathleen Stevenson. And here's an excerpt from that 1995 interview.
Right now, I wanted to ask you about a quote that I've heard from you. You say that we've been suffering in this country from Alzheimer's or a collective amnesia about the past. Mm. What should we be remembering? What should we be learning from the past?
Well, this century is perhaps the most explosive. I mean, I'm sure every, if I could use the word centurion, believes it, you know, that his time was the one. But think what's happened in the 20th century, the greatest depression ever, after a time considered normalcy, when the wise men slipped on a banana peel, hadn't the vaguest idea what happened, and cried out for big government to help them. Now, we see, here's where the Alzheimer's disease nationally hurts us. All the frauds today who speak of big government being the bête noire, when health and welfare are involved, not when it involves peeping Tomism on a grand scale, or for that matter, helping a bloated military budget, when, of course, it's wholly insane, there being no longer any quote-unquote evil empire. So there's a memory that is erased. Even many of those who survived, lived during the Great Depression, don't tell their kids or grandkids about it, because they blame themselves in many cases. They believe that, by God, maybe it was my fault. There's still those who believe it. They say, the man behind that mahogany desk who sits at the big boy is a better man than I am. Because if I were a good man, I'd be behind that. You know, this fraudulence is still had become the coin of the realm generally. But there's no memory of that. There's World War II, why it was and what was about, and big industry's role in it. There's the Cold War. McCarthy, by the way, McCarthy didn't lose. I think he won.
Really?
He won in the use of our language. During the McCarthy days, and not just he alone, HUAC, everything else, people, great many, were scared to talk about issues of seriousness. They might be considered subversive. So they talked of trivia, right? Not just sports, babies, well, not that babies are trivia, but the subject of that. They talked of celebrities and gossip just to be safe. Well, what is the conversation today? Precisely that. Then came that one aberration, a good one, the 60s, that it's fashionable to put down today, is it not? You know, I meet the press about three, four months ago. We hear the conservative, George Will, and the liberal, as they call him, Sam Donaldson, which, of course, is an oxymoron, he said, phrase, liberal Sam Donaldson. I mean, that's what I call lingo promiscuity. You know, but nonetheless, they agreed on one thing. They had a high old time with a kid from the 60s, and they put it down time of extremism, right, you know, and dopiness and everything else. The 60s was the one time the young had causes outside themselves. They had the Civil Rights Movement and Freedom Summer. They had the anti-war movement, of course, and that's being put down. You see, so, and finally we come to Reagan and the tremendous blows to labor, not that labor wasn't declining. We can talk about that. Kids' memory of how the 8-hour day, they don't know. And most of the young, and not most of the young, a great, the young are known as the conservative young, which in itself is a crazy phrase. Until this part of the century, the young students have always been defined as those challenging established values. All that, it's a new breed. Yet, of course, that's, remember, that's not the great many. The great many of the young are lost and bewildered and worried stiff. And they say, I'm not going to be as well off as the old man, which is a reversal of the American dream. All this in the computer, too. Well, who are the people best able to do the history of the century? Those who lived it, those who experienced it, the actual people who have some little insight and who are storytellers. And so, in a sense, that's what the book is about.
And is it that the Depression is the defining event for the people who have lived the century?
Well, it's certainly one of the defining events. Well, define my event, me. Well, of course, but nothing was learned from it because of this Alzheimer's disease. As to what caused it, oh, many things. The very nature of the control of the media through the years. You can't blame a discovery called television, for the use of it. Now, TV was good during the civil rights movement. First time people saw the dogs of Bull Connor and Jim Clark attacking women and kids. Well, that played a big role. So it can. However, the use to which it's made, and also the one-sidedness, you know, we speak of talk radio. I love to speak of the liberal media. It's the joke of the century. Look, talk radio. Who are the ones most heard? Rush into the boy, and his clones. Jimmy Hightower was knocked off the air. You know who Jimmy Hightower was?
Right.
Of Austin, Texas. Jimmy's a former commissioner of agriculture. He was terrific. He's been knocked off the air. They've got 99% of the pie, but it's not enough. It's got to be 100% of it. And then you've got public TV, described as left public TV. Here are the leftists. William Buckley Jr., has a show, right? Mm-hmm. John McLaughlin, leftist show. Tony Brown, who's a right-wing black guy. So, that's what I mean by the perversion of our language, too. So McCarthy's one there, too.
Right. Why do you think you've lasted so long in the media?
Me? Oh, because I'm stubborn. I don't know. And I'm around and about and varied in what I do, whether it be music or reading short stories or anything, you see. I'm just round and about, I guess. Nelson Aldrin, my friend, you say, a here and there fellow. And that's it.
Yeah, because you do a lot of things.
But there's no one reason. Known in Chicago to a great many. And even though they know this guy is strange in his politics, we still at studs. It's sort of known in town. But influence, I'm happy to say, a surprising number of people. So I've been told. I'd never thought I'd, but in hitting the turf, you know, the rest of the country, I'm delighted to bump into someone now and then who says they were affected by whatever it is I do.
Yeah. Well, I think you do influence a lot of people. I mean, just in preparing for you to come here, people handed us notes or said, I'm going to stop by when he's here, because they really do see you as sort of a hero of sorts. I don't know how that makes you feel.
What a hero. Boy, oh boy, oh boy. The heroes are the anonymous. You see, that's the point. In all these books, it's sort of bottom-up stuff. As a poem by Bertolt Brecht. First, if I ask somebody, not you, but someone else, who built the pyramids, the immediate reaction is the pharaohs did it. The big shots, the king. I mean, well, Pharaoh didn't lift a finger. None of the pharaohs did. Mrs. Pharaoh was Elizabeth Taylor. You know, her nails were manicured. But who built it? And so his poem goes, when the Chinese wall was built, where did the masons go for lunch? When Caesar conquered Gaul, was there not even a cook in the army? When the Armada sank, and it's the Spanish Armada, and we get those. I remember the date. I got that in History 1 or something at McKinley High School, Chicago, when the Armada, 1588 is the year, and Sir Francis Drake conquered the Spanish Armada. He did. Well, by himself. So when the Armada sank, writes Brecht, we read that King Philip wept, King of Spain. And here's the big one. Were there no other tears? And so, in a sense, these books I try to put out are about those who shed those other tears.
Right. And actually, that relates to a question I was going to ask you about heroes, because I would think, do you have heroes yourself? Are these people your heroes, the people that
Well, I think so. They're around and about. Peggy Terry, an Appalachian woman in Chicago, organized the Appalachian people. Peggy is a hero. Jacob Lawrence, the artist, is a hero. These are the ones who were with us, art and giftedness, but people in communities and neighborhoods around and about. Oh, there, I guess, celebrated hero would be someone like Gene Debs, I suppose, or Bob La Follette. Clarence Darrow, I guess, for me would be, because I went to law school. I'm dreaming of Clarence Darrow. And I wake up to Julius Hoffman. He was the judge of the conspiracy trial. I wake up to any Claude, say, and contracts and real property. I went nuts. But certainly Clarence Darrow would be one of my heroes. He changed, by the way. He was the railroad company's lawyer, you know, during that big strike. And he changed. The people who change. If I were to say one of my heroes, this will throw you, is the former Grand Dragon of the Ku Klux Klan. You might be surprised. Yet he is. His name is Claiborne P. Ellis. He's in a couple of the books. And his story is that of the poor white who's been fed on the lie all his life and bit by bit by bit discovers it. And his is a story of almost biblical in power. It's a story of, I think, of revelation and redemption. And he's great. His name is Claiborne P. Ellis, former Grand Dragon of the Ku Klux Klan of Durham, North Carolina. He's a hero of mine. Mm-hmm. So go do me something. Sue me.
The book, Coming of Age, one of the things that you notice in reading it is that there's certain current themes throughout that affect all these people who are 70 years old or older that you talk to. And one of them is the importance of work, which is also a theme in your book so much.
Well, in fact, this book might be considered something of a sequel to Work, as it's a sequel to Hard Times, the Depression book, a sequel to The Good War, too. But it's a sequel to Head the Changing of Work, the old carpenter in the book, talking about the new forms of prefab houses and electric saws, but the use of the hand tool. And that's one of Jacob Lawrence's grievances. To him, the hand tool. Remember, the hand to him was like, was to Frank Lloyd Wright. Frank Lloyd Wright, the architect, used the word organic for his architecture. Look at the hand, the fingers and the palm connected. You know, the roots, limbs of a tree and the trunk of a tree. It's organic. When somebody sits in an automobile, which, by the way, I don't drive. I never did. But when you sit in an automobile, it's anti-organic because you're removed from, you're in it and you're removed from the rest of the people. In fact, they're kind of your enemies.
Yeah.
And so, but anyway, hand tools and the hand affect Jacob Lawrence very much, and this guy Ray Koch, the carpenter, speaks of the forgetting to use the hand tools. The new form of work. Well, of course, we come to the computer, don't we? We come to industrial plants and the closings. Well, of course, there's a big immediate reason for the closings. Of course, the conglomerates taking over and the big boys. One of the jokes of our time is the subject of lack of loyalty. They mean lack of loyalty of employees to the company, which, of course, is the grandest joke of all. Here's one company that in this town provided work for Grandpa and for everybody else down the line. And they decide to close. A conglomerate takes it, someone else takes over, and they're going to move to Taiwan or get people for $2 a day, you know,
right,
or non-union territory in the South. And they say, the hell with the people who work there, give their sweat and tears to it. And so they speak of loyalty, a lack of loyalty. But back to the subject at hand, we come to the computerized age, which has its own feeling as far as I'm concerned.
There's
a point of no return sometimes. I'm not a Luddite. I don't want to destroy the machines, though at times there's a temptation. I'm not a Luddite because I believe in the washing machine. I don't want to see a woman smacking clothes against a rock all the time, you know, in the brook. And I'm for the refrigerator because where else am I going to freeze my martini glass? So I'm for that. But sometimes the computer gathers more information, doesn't it? It gathers more information more quickly. This much I understand. But what happens to the personal touch? For example, as a doctor in the book, by the minimum age of the book is 70, 70, because has a whole new period of life now in this century with the medical discoveries and technology. And so there's a doctor in this book, and he and this young intern, the doctor's discussing the patient, this patient they have. "How did she do last night?" says the old doctor, the young guy. And the young guy says, "Just a minute, doctor," and he punches into the computer. And out comes the latest lab test. And he looks at it, carries, "Oh, she's great. Look, doc." He says, the old guy says, "That's not what I ask you. What did she say to you last night? Was that pain different than the one she experienced the night before?" And the kid, the new doctor, says, "I don't know." "You don't know? Why did you become a doctor? Isn't it the laying on of the hands, the personal touch?" That's one example, see. Another might be the you go to a city room, in the editorial room of a newspaper. And in the old days, there was kind of a noise, a human noise of sorts. There was a sound of the telephone talking, a guy calling out or a woman calling out, and you're running. There was sound, human voices calling across. Today, it's silent as a tomb, because there they are, the young reporters, male, female, next to one another. Each one, though, is looking into that window of that terminal, the word terminal, and it's as though they're all peeping Toms. They're looking in there. What are they seeing? They're seeing something dirty or something sexy across there. They're looking into it. So at the same time, even though they're right next to one another, they're miles apart. There's no connection, and it's silent as a tomb. See, that's the example of what happens. So I make a telephone call, right? And so I call up, "Is Charlie Miller there?" And a human voice used to answer, "Charlie's not in." I said, "Could I leave a message?" "Sure." "Okay. Now, is Charlie Miller there?" And a voice, a machine, a zombie voice says, "If you want so-and-so, push one. If you want the personnel, push two. Administrator." It goes up to six. By the time they get to six, my blood pressure has risen alarmingly, and I forgot who the hell it was I called. So we have it again. And I'm exaggerating, of course. But you see, I'm a hi-fi Philistine, is what I am. I'm just not up on the stuff. The language itself confuses me. If you say, "Well, on the internet, enter what?" You know, I don't know. For example, hardware and software, right? Hardware is hammer and nails and pots and pans. Software, pillowcases and sheets and Turkish towels. And so I'm horsing around, it's true, but it's basically true.
Right. And you get a sense from hearing from these people that are interviewed that they have mixed feelings about technology. Many of them refer to it, and they appreciate certain aspects of it, but they certainly don't know quite what to do about all the effects that you're talking about.
Yeah, well, do the young know what to do with it? That's a big question. By the way, since you raised old, this book is not a put-down of the young. It's the opposite. Almost everybody in this book has had a pretty full, rich, rewarding life. But they all are connected one way or another with battle of the community, aside from him herself. Grassroots, not all, but that's the idea.
Mm-hmm.
But they all have pretty full lives. And they have rueful moments, of course, throughout. Maybe I neglected my own kids in this outside. That comes into it. But they grieve for the young, primarily. They grieve for them. They don't bawl them out. They grieve for them because no history. Where to, what next, you know? 5 years to go, and we're the end of a century and the beginning of a new, get this, millennium. You would think, in thought, you know, before Einstein died, and I always love to quote Einstein. You know why? Because nobody dares contradict me. Einstein, you know, blamed himself for the bomb. In a sense, he did. He's like a Greek hero, you know. He's a Greek hero. He really is. He's this guy who was so great and gifted and humane, and his equation led to the experiments, and finally to Los Alamos. He convinced Roosevelt. He was the only guy who could convince Roosevelt to bomb because they were afraid the Nazis would have it. It turns out they were nowhere near it, but that was the fear. Well, he never dreamed they'd be dropped on humans. But he said, with the split of the atom, everything in the world has changed irrevocably, except one thing, the way we think. We have to think in wholly new terms. Global village, of course, even beyond that. So there'll always be battles, but that you be on a higher level, for God's sake, than it is now. That's the point, a higher plateau.
Is that what it is? Because I know you, I was reading your... You're talking to myself, your memoir, and you've written a new kind of ending to it. And you have you assume that you were elected president in 1984.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, that, I wrote that one about for an earlier edition. It was an added edition. The ultimate fantasy about my being elected president in 1984 on an independent ticket, of course, overwhelmingly, and my program. And basically, all this is part of it. But the new one is I saw my Freedom of Information files. And so and one is my exchange of letters with John Edgar Hoover, which is a funny. It's too long to go into. It's very funny. I almost became a fingerprint classifier, civil service job, back in the Depression days. That means I'd have been working for the FBI. So it's an exchange of letters, and I find it very amusing. Actual letters, you know. He was called the director, and he'd send back letters, you know, about this applicant for a job that paid $12.60 a year. I think it was $14.40, second lowest. But in any event, it has all kinds of... What I might have been is the afterward. It's just come out.
Right. And you talk in there about people I think it's disenthralling themselves from the ideas that they have.
Yeah, well, you know, that's a quote paraphrase of Lincoln. Lincoln, we must disenthrall ourselves from something, the tired dogmas of the past. Something that, whatever there were a time for it, it's this moment. Because if we don't, I don't know, I'm not going to be Nostradamus, but it ain't going to be good.
Yeah, and you mentioned the fact that there is the people who feel... For the young people facing our current situation, there's a definite theme among these people that you've written their thoughts that this is the time that they wouldn't want to be young in.
That, a good many, you know, that question comes up. Do you want to make the year 2000? Maybe these people, 80, some 85, 86, 87, like John Kenneth Galbraith. And he's become, just since I mentioned him, he speaks of the irony, those who put down big government, you know, he says. And so they were just about to jump out of windows then, in the 30s, the crash, and along comes the New Deal, helps them out, and it's big government. It's as though you're kicking the ladder out from under after it helped you climb to safe ground, you know. But they say, would I want to live? A number of them say, no, I'd just so not. Others say, I'm curious, I want to make it, you know. So it's a combination of both. I'm half and half.
Really?
Half and half. Oh, of course I want to make it. I'm 83 now. I want to make it out of curiosity. But it, I don't know. It's one of those. So I was born the year the Titanic went down, that year, 1912. And that itself is something. The Titanic went down, I come up. As someone once said, who said life was fair? But in any event, that's that event itself, the Titanic, the greatest ship ever built, nothing is going to get that. Man's arrogance toward nature. We think about what the polluters are doing, the clear cutters are doing, the, you know, the subduing nature. They're gonna kill nature. And so here you got the Titanic, the biggest, a little tip of ice, bang, at the end of the Titanic. That much of the iceberg, you would think there's something, hey, way we got to respect this thing called nature, somewhere or other. Not let it dominate us, of course you have to have, but somewhere along the line there has to be a cooperative getting along with nature. How presumptuous we are getting, has to be getting along with nature. But we're doing everything to knock ourselves off with the pollution aspects of it. Here's the Titanic and the and a bit of ice.
Yeah.
You think we've learned something.
That was author, historian, actor, and broadcaster Studs Terkel speaking with KABU's Kathleen Stevenson in the KABU studios in 1995. Studs was on tour for his book Coming of Age, Growing Up in the 20th Century. And you're listening to KBOO Portland, KABU.FM on the web.